good morning, and thank you for coming to the Center for Strategic International Studies for our briefing on the President's trip to Asia. I'm Andrew Schwartz. I'm our Vice President for External Relations here at CSIS, and I see a lot of familiar faces, and I see some new faces, and thank you all for coming this morning. I'd like to point out we passed out a couple things that may be helpful. One is a new report on the United States and Korea leading beyond the storm. This is a report of CSIS's Scholl Chair in International Business, namely my colleague Steve Schrage to the left over here. And this report has some excellent charts in the back, too, that I hope you get a chance to take a look at. Another thing is one of our colleagues who's traveling overseas who would be with us today, Victor Cha, our Korea Chair. Victor's prepared an edition of our critical questions, President Obama's trip to Asia. This will be emailed out as well. And I urge you all to register for our critical questions, which you can do at csis.org. With that, I know we have a busy morning ahead of us and a lot to talk about. I'd like to introduce my colleague, Mike Green, who's a senior advisor at CSIS and our Japan chair, to my immediate left. And then next to Mike, we have Bonnie Glazer, who's one of our senior China scholars and works in our China Studies department. Next, we have Ernie Bauer. Ernie's our newest scholar here at CSIS, and we are really, really proud to have him. He's known to many of you, and he's certainly known to us, and really completes our team in Asia with his expertise in Southeast Asia in particular. Then, of course, we have Steve Schrage, our business chair, who I mentioned earlier. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Green, who's going to deliver some opening remarks. Thank you.
We keep it cold down here for these morning sessions, so people stay awake. But I think the heat's going to come on, so bear with us. I spent 5 years on the National Security Council staff preparing visits to Asia exactly like the one President Obama is going to be taking next week. I did it for President Bush, five visits to the region and to APEC like this one. I was thinking through what my successors would be putting into the scope memo for the president, and which he's probably writing right about now, in terms of the narrative that the White House would like you all to write about the trip and about each stop, and also about the sub-narratives or trouble areas that the White House hopes you probably won't write about that could become problems in each stop. So I'm not in the White House anymore, and feel free to share with you what I would guess are the storylines they'd like you to write on each stop and the ones they hope you won't write, which may or may not become problems, but I think are worth watching. In terms of the overall theme of the trip, there's no doubt about that one. Asia is becoming the most dynamic region in the world. It's the source of recovery from the current economic crisis. It is the region that has the most intense 19th century style great power rivalry among Japan, China, Korea, India. It's a region that presents some of the toughest proliferation challenges, but it's also a region where some of the most important developments are happening in terms of democratization and development. So it's a very mixed bag, and it's very much becoming the center of international attention. It's not the center of attention in Washington, though. The center of attention in Washington, I think, over the next 2 weeks will be, in terms of foreign policy, how President Obama will respond to the proposal from General McChrystal. And it struck me that the White House has signaled they're going to make this decision after the trip, which, based on my experience, means a good 30 to 50% of the president's time managing the press on this trip is going to be about Afghanistan. And that's good news, bad news. It could be a distraction from some of the problems in Asia, but also it's going to be a distraction from what is generally a very good story for the U.S. and I think for the administration in terms of Asia policy. The president is popular in Asia, as he is in Western Europe and other parts of the world, and I'm sure they're going to want to play on that and look for venues and opportunities to emphasize that his personal popularity and his policies are bringing American leadership back into the region. As a former Bush administration official, I would only point out that most opinion polls in the region at the end of the Bush administration showed that the U.S. was more popular at the end of the Bush administration in Asia than they were at the end of the Clinton administration. The Chicago Council on Global Affairs did a survey last year on soft power. They asked across Asia what countries have the most influence and they measured in a variety of ways. You know, what culture do you like? Whose diplomacy is most effective? And the U.S. came out across the region as number one. They actually the Chicago Council hired a China scholar to analyze it, thinking the result would be China has the most soft power in Asia. China came in third across the region after the U.S. and Japan. One of the questions they asked was, what country has increased its influence the most over the past 10 years? And every other country in the region said the U.S. The two countries said the U.S. did not increase its influence. Chinese public said China had increased its influence the most, although the rest of the region didn't see it that way. And then the American public said that we had lost influence. So we think we're pretty bad. but the polls and the overall storyline over the last 10 years has been that American standing in Asia is pretty good. And I think that President Obama can add on top of that his own personal popularity, which is higher than President Bush's on a personal level across the region. Other things to keep in mind, this trip is happening. It's the last major foreign trip for the president and the last series of summits before Copenhagen. And I think in every stop you'll see that the White House is trying to emphasize progress, especially with China, but also with Japan, Korea, and an APEC on climate change. And, of course, the economic recovery. Now, going through the itinerary, the first stop is Japan on the 12th and 13th of November. The theme the White House will want to emphasize, and the Japanese too, is reaffirming the commitment of both governments to this alliance. The Obama administration has essentially followed what was a Bush strategy and began in the Clinton era of emphasizing Japan as the cornerstone of our Asia strategy, as one way to engage China from a position of greater confidence and influence. But the Japanese threw a bit of a curveball to the U.S. with this election August 30th, and you have a new government. The Democratic Party of Japan is the leader of the coalition that is not anti-American and that is certainly committed to the alliance, but is a much more populist party and has thrown out a lot of promises to the Japanese people about reducing the size of U.S. bases, creating a more equal alliance. Prime Minister Hatsuyama recently in Beijing, appearing with Hu Jintao, said that Japan has been too dependent on the United States. These are themes that are not especially welcome in the White House, but a lot of them are sort of vague, and I think that the U.S.-Japan alliance remains important in Japan. 76% of the public says the alliance is important. So I don't think either side expects major shifts, but the themes coming out of this new government are problematic for the White House. I think you will see the president emphasizing the importance of the alliance, perhaps pointing to next year, the 50th anniversary of the 1960 Security Treaty, as an opportunity to revitalize and strengthen the alliance. There will be some initiatives on climate and energy that the White House will clearly want to emphasize. The storyline that they cannot avoid, that they probably want to avoid but cannot avoid, is about Okinawa and the bases, because the new government has said that they will not move forward with, well, actually what they said they would not move forward with an agreement we have to move half the Marines to Guam and build a new base in Okinawa. It's in the weeds, but it's a lot of our forward presence. And the new government said that in their campaign promise they wouldn't implement it. What Prime Minister Hatsuyama said is he won't make a decision about it until next year. And Secretary Gates was in Japan October 20th and came down pretty hard on the Japanese government publicly, saying you can't put this off. The longer you put it off, the more the local opposition will build to it and the entire deal will fall apart. I doubt President Obama will be as publicly tough as Gates was, but he's not going to change the policy line of the U.S. So that's going to be one that's going to be difficult to manage. When I was in the White House, we used to go to Korea with some trepidation because you never knew what Nomu Hyun was going to say when he was president in Korea. I think this White House is going to Japan with a similar certain uncertainty about what's going to happen there. November 13 to 15, the president's in Singapore for APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. Ernie's going to talk more about the summit with ASEAN. APEC is the most important trans-Pacific economic forum in Asia. There are more than 70 free trade arrangements in Asia right now, and the U.S. is only really involved in a very small handful. And the way we keep at the center of economic integration in Asia is by having a dynamic Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum process. And you have Singapore this year, Japan next year, and the U.S. the year after that. So there's a feeling among the business community and foreign policy experts that we really can build a lot of momentum for a trans-Pacific series of agreements that would keep the U.S. locked in and prevent a closed regional bloc. And that's certainly the theme that's going to come out of this APEC summit. I'm sure Steve will say more about this. The problem is the U.S. brings absolutely nothing to the table. The one agreement we have signed and ready to go with Korea is the biggest trade liberalizing agreement in Asia and would absolutely lock in a trans-Pacific trade liberalization process and give us real credibility in APEC. It's not moving. My understanding is they had a White House meeting. The international people, state and others said, we got to do something. The word is that the White House political said, we can't. We got to focus on health care, climate change legislation. So the subtext I think the White House will want you to avoid on this one is they don't have anything to work with when the rest of the region is negotiating all sorts of agreements. We'll have time, you know, next year, the year after, but the problem is APEC is hosted the year after. Next year is Japan, year after that's U.S., the year after that is Russia. People don't expect much. And so you start, the hosts matter a lot. And by the time we get our act together, it may be too late to add vitality to APEC. I think it's a problem. The business community is concerned. China, are you going to do China? October 15th to 18th. The administration has talked about a constructive and comprehensive relationship. Have I got the C's right?
No.
What are they?
Positive, cooperative,
and comprehensive. Thank you. The only thing I would say is for the Bush administration, the three C's were constructive, cooperative, and candid. The candid has been dropped, and we'll see how that plays. I'll let Bonnie say more about China. The things that I'm expecting are certainly some big deliverables on climate and energy, but not anything that involves Chinese commitments on greenhouse gas emission caps or participating in the Kyoto climate change arrangements. So it's going to be good spin, perhaps, but not clear how much substance it gives for Copenhagen. And the president's going to have, I think, some pressure to articulate what his position is on human rights and democracy and Tibet, because he chose in October not to see the Dalai Lama here, and he's the first president to have done that since 1991. In Korea, that's November 18, 19, pretty good visit. One night, Lee Myung-bak, the president of Korea, is pro-U.S. He's a pragmatist. His economy is doing pretty well. Korea hosts the G20 next year. There's a lot of good stuff to talk about. The subtext or the question that I think the Korean press is really going to be looking at is the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement. And the Korean government would like the administration, would like the president. They know he's not going to announce in Seoul that he's going to submit it to the Congress. But they'd like more than they got when President Lee was here in June, which was a statement that the president supports, in principle, the free trade agreement, but thinks that we have to fix it. The Korean side would like more than that. They've staked a lot in this, and they have some leverage because they're negotiating an agreement with the EU that, when it comes into force, is going to disadvantage U.S. business. So they'll put a little friendly pressure on President Obama. Bonnie's going to talk about North Korea. The Korean press will talk a little bit about the grand bargain that President Lee has proposed for North Korea. There's, frankly, not that much there. He's a conservative a skeptic of North Korea. He's putting out some aspirational vision of what could happen if North Korea gave up nuclear weapons. That's extremely unlikely, and so a grand bargain with North Korea is extremely unlikely, but you'll see a certain amount about that. And then he heads home. And if, from my experience, does not talk to his Asia team for a month because he's sick of Asia because he's been on the road for almost 2 weeks. And back to the next part of the storyline.
The president will spend about 4 days in China. He arrives in Shanghai, I understand, late or in the evening on Sunday. This is President Obama's first ever visit to China, so this is going to be a combination of some sightseeing and obviously important meetings with the Chinese leaders. The itinerary is not set. I can give you a sense of some of the things that are being considered, but nothing has been finalized as I understand it. The U.S. is interested in organizing a town hall type meeting in Shanghai with Chinese youth for the president to engage with. My expectation is if this comes off, it will be handpicked individuals from a leading university in Shanghai like Fudan, probably not too dissimilar from President Clinton's meeting that he had when he was there, I think, in 97. The president will give a speech, probably, as I've heard, at Tsinghua University in Beijing. There may be some kind of an internet component to one of these events where President Obama might have an opportunity to engage with netizens. President Hu Jintao has done that in the past, engaged with Chinese netizens, and that's something that no U.S. president has done before. There's a big expo being planned in Shanghai in 2010. One of the possible things on the agenda is to have the president go visit the site where they are going to build the U.S. I don't even think it's started construction yet. I could be wrong. They're still fundraising. But Secretary Clinton has been very involved in that, and that might be on the agenda. In terms of deliverables for this visit, there's going to be a joint statement. And again, that is still being negotiated. Lots of brackets, I hear, in a very long document. I think the highlight will be the interdependent nature of the U.S. And Chinese relationship, both in economic and security terms. As Mike mentioned, it was April 1st that President Obama first met with President Hu in the margins of the G20 in London, and that is where they agreed on this label of a positive, cooperative, and comprehensive relationship. This trip is an opportunity to really put some meat on the bones, if you will, of this statement. What is it that we are actually going to cooperate on? And in terms of comprehensiveness, how many things are we going to work on together? The U.S.-China relationship has been, in the past, mostly bilateral and increasingly regional. Under this administration, we're seeing it increasingly focus on global issues, things like climate change, of course, the economic financial crisis. And this is, I think, really a test of whether or not our two countries are going to be able to step up and do much on these really global issues. The U.S., I think, would like to see China take on more responsibility, not just on those issues, but also North Korea and Iran. There's some discussion of some form of cooperation on Afghanistan. There may be an announcement that the Chinese will train police in Afghanistan. That's something that's still being looked at. And I expect no breakthroughs on either North Korea or Iran, as I agree with Mike, that on climate change. We will see something on clean energy cooperation. That's really where the focus of the discussions are. When Hu Jintao was in New York at the UN, he said that China would reduce its emissions, of course, did not set any target, and there's no expectation that in the run-up to Copenhagen that the Chinese will agree to set a target. I'll just say a couple of things on North Korea and then on the security issues for APEC. The Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao was in Pyongyang and elicited a statement from Kim Jong-il that they would like to see bilateral talks with the United States, and depending on the progress of those talks, that there could be multilateral discussion. What he actually said, although it was reported that that could include six-party talks, he actually told the Chinese that it could include three-party, four-party, or six-party talks. And my impression from talking with the Chinese is that the six-party is the least desirable among those choices. My impression is that the administration is continuing to engage bilaterally. We just had Sung Kim out in San Diego talking with the North Korean representative that was participating in the Northeast Asia Cooperation Dialogue out in San Diego. And I think that there is a willingness on the part of the Obama administration to send Steve Bosworth, our special representative, to Pyongyang. The word is there will be no more than two meetings, and my expectation is that this will happen after President Obama's visit to the region. But the North Koreans continue to avoid making any clear statements on whether they will return to their commitments under the six-party talks. That includes the September 2005 agreement, the February 2007 agreement, and their commitments to, of course, denuclearization. Finally, just in a couple of sentences, there are some security issues on the agenda for APEC. Not likely to see this in any joint statement. The emphasis in APEC is on the E. It's on economic. There are some reservations by some of the parties to including security issues in a joint statement, but nevertheless there will be some discussion, and those issues are likely to be North Korea, Burma, the NPT, and Iran.
Should I just jump in? Hi, everybody. First of all, I seem a little grouchy this morning. I was born in Philadelphia, so I hope that explains that.
Me too.
Were you? Yeah. All right. President Obama will go to Singapore for APEC, as Mike mentioned. He's going to be there with a good portion of his economic and foreign policy team. I think that's important to note. You know, this is the first time in a while that we've had the Secretary of Treasury along with the team. Geithner will be there. Hillary Clinton will be there from the State Department. Gary Locke from Commerce and Ron Kirk from USTR. Expectations at APEC, you know, it's in Singapore. Singapore is the most trade-dependent country in the world. Trade in Singapore is equivalent to over 300% of GDP. Singapore is sort of the canary in the coal mine on trade. If trade stalls or dies, Singapore will be the bird on the floor in the mine. And that's not good. Also, Singapore is right in the center of ASEAN, which is a 10-country group of countries comprises of 650 million people, over $1 trillion GDP. If you don't count Canada and Mexico, since they're adjacent to the United States, it's our third overseas largest trading partner. So trade is very important to this group of countries. As in terms of trade as a percentage of GDP for all the countries of ASEAN, it would average just under 100 or just over 100%. So trade is going to be important, as Mike alluded to. I don't think the Americans are going to be able to arrive in Singapore and do the needful, as far as the Asians are concerned, on trade. There's going to be a lot of pressure on the United States to say something about strong commitment to wrapping up a Doha round, and I think maybe Steve will talk a little bit more about that. For a number of reasons, politics in this town, healthcare, Afghanistan, others. I don't think the White House is willing to use those chits, they're not ready to talk about trade like Asia would like it to. So there's going to be a little a strange dynamic out there. There are meetings going on probably as we speak inside the administration right now, trying to decide what they can do on trade, and maybe Steve will talk a little bit more about this. That will color the tone a bit, I think. But we can't forget that in Southeast Asia, President Obama is personally extremely popular. I think, you know, Mike pointed this out, but particularly in Singapore, in Southeast Asia, Obama's got better popularity ratings than he does in Virginia and Wisconsin in places like Indonesia and Malaysia. So it's interesting. I mean, there's a rock star factor there, and I think he'll enjoy that. Out there, for those of you that are traveling, you'll feel the love. In terms of APEC, I think, as Mike pointed out, there's going to be a couple themes that the White House probably doesn't want to emphasize that will probably make headlines. There'll be a lot of reporting on Burma. Assistant Secretary of State Kurt Campbell and the U.S. Ambassador to ASEAN, Scott Marcel, just are coming out of Burma today. I guess that's right. Yeah, they've been there for a couple of days. They met Aung San Suu Kyi. They met the prime minister. In a way, this will be a very positive story in Asia because I think a lot of our friends in Asia have been waiting for the United States to step up and try to do more on engagement in Burma. That's the new policy. That's what Campbell and Marcel were doing there. There's going to be a lot of discussion about that. Significantly, while the president is in Singapore, he will sit down for the first time with all 10 of the ASEAN heads of state. I'd be happy to give more background on who those 10 are. But for the first time, the Burmese are at the table, which is a new step for the United States. They're at the table in a head of state capacity. In terms of the U.S.-ASEAN summit, I think what's happening here is the United States basically is getting the form right, but the substance of that meeting, don't hold your breath for big home runs coming out of that meeting. I don't think there'll be significant new statements about new money or new training. I think in a way, being there is what's important this year. The Vietnamese are very interested in promulgating the idea of continuation of the U.S.-ASEAN summit happening next year. They are chairing ASEAN next year. They are pushing the administration, the White House, to come to Vietnam next year. It's the 15th anniversary of U.S.-Vietnam relations next year. It's also Hanoi's 1,000th anniversary. These are important things when you're in Hanoi. And it's really interesting because I think there's a confluence right now of U.S. and Vietnamese interest in strengthening ASEAN. We both want to see a strong ASEAN. The Vietnamese, particularly so because they live and have lived for thousands of years on China's border. And I think when they joined ASEAN in 1997, they were very disappointed that ASEAN was not as effective a group to stand up to the Chinese. And that is going to manifest itself. I think we'll see some talk and some discussion out of the U.S.-ASEAN summit, or at least press stories, about the South China Sea and the Spratlys. This is a big issue for the Vietnamese. It's a lesser issue for the Filipinos. But there are six countries that have claims on the South China Sea, and the Chinese are extremely the South China Sea is one of those issues where the Chinese have not been able to get over themselves. You know, the ideological sort of tone that China had 10 years ago, they've abandoned that in this, you know, when the financial crisis, Southeast Asia, Asian financial crisis started, the Chinese really took a giant leap forward on diplomacy. They really exercised a charm offensive that was really helped them advance their interests in Southeast Asia. And they were able to listen and talk. But the one issue that I think they haven't been able to really come around on is the South China Sea. And it's a very delicate issue. The Southeast Asians, including Lee Kuan Yew, who was here last week, have encouraged the United States to, you know, be engaged in this. The question is, how do we do that? It's not an easy question, I think, for us. And it's not an easy issue for the Chinese. So I expect this to be one of the issues that's covered. The president also meet with President Yudhoyono. He's the president of Indonesia, which, as you know, is the fourth largest country in the world. It's the largest Muslim country. President Obama decided not to go to Indonesia. I think that was handled probably pretty well here. I won't go into it unless there are questions, but I think getting the U.S.-Indonesia relationship right is going to be a very important part of U.S. policy in Southeast Asia and an important part of this trip. There are some real problems. We've got real serious trade issues with Indonesia that are sort of at the company level, regional level, and bilateral. We need to get those back on track, and hopefully President Yudhoyono's new cabinet will be able to do some things that his previous cabinet was not able to do. I think we also want to do a lot more work in Southeast Asia on the healthcare area. That's been a problem because of a difficult minister in Indonesia, health minister in Indonesia. She's gone now. There could be an opportunity to maybe do more in the area, in Indonesia, also in the rest of Southeast Asia. On climate change, I agree. It'll be a key theme. The United States has done a good job of engaging in key issues. Hillary Clinton took the initiative to to join in with the Mekong countries and talk about the damming of the Mekong River. I think that's that engagement in mainland Southeast Asia is particularly appreciated by countries like Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand. So I think I'll wrap up there and happy to answer any questions you have about some of those specific issues.
Thanks. I'm Stephen Schrage. I'm the International Business Chair, the Schulte International Business here, and kind of coming at this more from my background at USTR, and then I'm working with Colin Powell on strategic issues, and chair is the G8's Crime and Terrorism Group. I kind of have an appreciation for some of these multilateral efforts, but also I would say kind of a healthy skepticism of how much they can get done in the current context. And I think it's been hit on a couple times here. I think there are other issues that the White House or others may want you to focus on at this point in time. But kind of in the context of this being the first APEC and really the first trip since the global economic crisis turned a lot of these nations' economic assumptions on their head, you know, how you're going to revive global growth, what's going to happen with trade is really going to be the elephant in the room for a lot of these countries. And it's one where currently the United States doesn't have a lot to say. And it's going to be a critical question that's going to come out throughout this trip. I think both for APEC and for President Obama, you know, the question will be, is there a roadmap to revive trade or to put things on the right course? Or kind of as U.S. and APEC efforts stall, are they going to be left in the rearview mirror by Asian countries, by new groupings that are going to move forward potentially without us? And I think, you know, as America confronts this issue, we're going to see a lot of different things over the next year. They're going to push this to the agenda. You're going to see it at this trip at APEC, and then capping next year with the APEC in Japan that Mike mentioned, with the G20 in Korea. It's really going to raise questions about, do we have a comprehensive way forward? To start with APEC, which I think has a great deal of potential, it was launched by one of my former bosses, Bob Zelek, and really injected the U.S. in the discussions in Asia, along with the other countries in the Americas, at a critical time, helped push forward the WTO. And as you heard, it's got some very impressive stats. You know, it's 50% of world trade, 60% of U.S. exports. But what I think what people would say over the last several years, it's been somewhat less impressive in terms of actual results and seizing that capability. And, you know, the question is, can it be known for something in terms of real substantive achievements rather than kind of those famous but somewhat awkward pictures of world leaders in colorful shirts or, you know, just, you know, continuing to have this kind of dialogue going forward? It's facing challenges in its own backyard. As been mentioned, ASEAN, you know, is moving forward trade deals, ASEAN plus three, ASEAN plus six. There's an East Asian summit. There's talks of an East Asian community that might exclude the United States. So as a regional grouping, it's facing challenges. But then as a global grouping, you know, the numbers sound very impressive. It's 50% of global GDP. But then you've got a G20 that was just launched that is 80%, 85% or higher of global GDP and includes almost half of it's from APEC. So it's, you know, what is it? What does it serve, this global role? Is it a regional role? Should it be tackling these security issues that Bonnie mentioned? It's kind of really struggling for a way forward and how it fits into this new global architecture. At a time when President Obama has said and others have said we need to kind of rationalize these structures going forward. So as you well know, going from summit to summit to summit to summit and figuring out how we structure these overall. I think President Obama and the administration faced some similar questions, particularly on trade. I don't think anyone would fault the Obama administration with doing a strategic review of trade. I think it was greatly needed. Trade had really hit a brick wall in the last years of the Bush administration. We didn't see a lot of substantive progress on FTAs or the Doha round. But now we're reaching a time where this kind of void in U.S. leadership, as it drags on, is being filled by other nations rapidly moving forward, and we're really losing our window in terms of ability to lead. I think you can contrast this. You know, it's a pretty clear picture and a sharp contrast between the U.S. and Asia. You've got Asian countries, dynamic center of growth, World Bank estimates of 7.8% of growth driving the global recovery, engaged in negotiations throughout the region and the world, you know, over 16 negotiations already completed. And then in contrast, you've got a United States where there's questions about high unemployment, whether we're going to have a jobless recovery, and, you know, our FTA efforts stalled. We've got two with the region in contrast to those over 60. You know, and the last one was a half decade ago. Our major agreement with Korea, you know, is up in the air without a clear way forward. And Congress hasn't even given authority back to the president to get back in the game and start negotiating on these things, which could hold back things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's been discussed, or ASEAN FTA negotiations, things that are being kicked around. So it's really kind of it's going to be a critical test for the Obama administration, both regionally but also globally. As the WTO stalls, is it time for a new approach to maybe look beyond regionalism to pull nations together? And that's something, you know, we can discuss more. And then finally, just quickly, I think, you know, we've touched on most of the specific bilateral issues, but just from a trade perspective, a couple that may come up. You know, there's been a lot of talk about China and the United States forming a G2 to drive the global agenda, but I think that may be premature when you're seeing major conflicts of the United States or disagreements on things like intellectual property rights, currency, services. So I think a lot of the focus will be kind of avoiding a trade war between China and the United States, or tamping those fears down at a time when you've had U.S. Tire tariffs and threats of Chinese action against the U.S. auto industries, rather than the China and U.S. coming together with a concrete agenda to drive world trade. You know, Korea, I think, you know, in addition to Japan, which I think Mike addressed in depth, one thing on Korea is that I think it's one of the most underappreciated but critical relationships given the dynamics that are in the region right now. And obviously the elephant in the room in that agreement is the U.S.-Korea FTA and where that goes forward. But another key part is going to be the G20. You know, this is – Obama's legacy is really wrapped into this – oops, Mikey. but just – Mike, you all right there?
Yeah,
it's all yeah, but, all right, got it. Well, we'll survive that catastrophe. But just the G20, you know, is going to be a chance to reboot the relationship. Obama's legacy, you know, inherited it from Bush, but he really chose to drive it forward, make it the centerpiece of the global economic cooperation efforts. And so both his and the Korea's legacies are really going to be tied to that. So that's an opportunity to reboot it. And just in closing, I'd say a lot of these statistics you kind of can lump together. We've kind of done a lot of different charts showing kind of how the U.S. has fallen behind on Korea trade, the FTAs, so, and how the spaghetti bowl of, you know, almost sweeping the entire world is really tilting the playing field against U.S. exporters. So I encourage you to take a look at those if, you know, you want to get more of a handle on how some of these statistics play out with Korea and also globally with the U.S. and Asia.
With that, we'll take your questions, but I should say it's a good thing that I lost weight because it looks like we're going to have to trade suits today.
It's a good thing CSI serves cold coffee.
Yeah. Let's open up to questions. George.
George Condon with Congress Daily. You've said a lot of interesting things about trade, but there's a whole group of questions that still are out there. I mean, Mike, you mentioned business leaders are concerned, wondering what the commitment of the president is. Are the foreign leaders also having that doubt? Do they think that he's a protectionist or a free trader? There's been some talk about the president having to give a speech on his trade policy. Is that something you're hearing about? And finally, are the other leaders going to wait for the United States, or are they ready to just move ahead and leave the United States out?
The APEC has a business, an Asia-Pacific-wide business organization associated with it called ABAC. And ABAC has called for more in terms of trade facilitation and more in terms of using APEC to define green goods and services. This is one of the big debates in WTO. Can we lower tariffs on goods and services related to climate and energy? So the business community is asking for more. As a political matter, the U.S. business community, I think, the Chamber of Commerce is now in a celebrity death match with the White House over health care and climate change. So I don't get the sense that the business community in Washington is throwing a lot of weight into this fight yet. But you talk to people and they're worried about it, because a lot of these free trade agreements, there are over 70 in Asia, are frankly fairly low, what you would call low quality. They're not necessarily consistent with WTO rules. But they're down payments, and they're beginning to build relationships. And some of them, especially with the ones that Koreans are doing with Europe, and now Japan is increasingly interested in doing some with Europe, those would actually have a significant trade-distorting effect and hurt U.S. business. So this is a growing problem. APEC's the best way for the U.S. to start countering it with proposals for region-wide and Trans-Pacific agreements, in addition to Korea and other bilateral things like TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. But and I think USTR and state would like to move on these, but they have a red light from the White House because of the domestic politics here. So business is not happy. The Koreans, underneath it are not happy. They've invested a lot of political capital into the agreement. They think they need it to deal with their growing dependence on China economically. And within the ASEAN process, Ernie can say more. The ASEANs don't like big, giant trade liberalizing agreements, but they'd like something from us. So I think there's going to be a certain amount of frustration from the business community and other leaders in the region. Even Japan, the new government proposed a free trade agreement with the U.S., which is very ambitious. So I think there's a sense that the U.S. should be doing more, and you'll hear that on this trip. I don't know if others want to.
Just a quick follow-up on that. We have one FTA in with the ASEAN countries. The U.S.-Singapore FTA is kind of considered the gold-plated, model that we'd like to pursue in other countries. But we have two on the table that are just sitting there, just like the U.S.-Korea FTA, that we started to negotiate and have just been dropped as part of this trade policy review, the U.S.-Malaysia FTA and the U.S.-Thai FTA. I don't think the Thais are ready to do anything right now because they're focused on their own problem. But the Malaysians probably are ready to come back to the table when we are. Now, I think the administration has been sending pretty careful signals that, hey, we're not gone on trade. Please wait for us. We've got to get health care done. And when we do that, we'll be back to the table on trade and on some of these regional agreements and some of the bilateral agreements. Do Asian leaders believe that? I'm not sure. To be honest with you, I don't think the guys in Southeast Asia that I deal with, they're not sure the Americans are going to make the corner. Does Obama get health care? Does he really use his political chits this year? And will he be back to the table on an aggressive trade policy? Can he manage a Democratic Congress on trade? I think there's a lot of questions out there. And I don't see, as I look around, my posse of friends in Southeast Asia, I don't see a lot of people convinced that the Americans will be able to come to the table next year, and particularly not at APEC, with a robust position to be able to exercise on trade.
I think what the big shift has been, it used to be that people thought they would kind of wait for the United States to come up with an agenda and go forward. But I think because of this lag and this void, increasingly now the U.S. is turning to these partners and they're moving forward. They're looking for other ways forward. Right. And while there was this assumption that the United States could just kind of sit on the sidelines and then jump in and kind of dictate the terms, particularly with Asia's dramatic growth, I don't know if that's the same case that it was before. And I think you're seeing that flow through all these negotiations, and you are seeing, again, the skepticism of whether the Obama administration, for all the positive statements it said since it came into office in contrast to some of the campaign statements, is it going to invest the political capital? And is Congress going to give it the authority to move forward on these? And I think as opposed to previous points in time where you're seeing this dramatic rise in Asia and the rest of the world, we're really at risk of falling behind if we don't come up with a coherent strategy soon. And I would say it's both in terms of engaging Asia bilaterally, but also overall with the WTO stalled. I mean, you look at the world now, it's a sea of conflicting agreements and spaghetti bowls and no real common standards around the world. And without U.S. leadership, it's going to give the ability of other nations to drive those issues. One thing I would point out, too, they mentioned the EU-Korea FTA. And, I mean, I think this is really a critical and probably not as well understood factor. I mean, you look at the combined economies of Korea and the EU, and it's larger than the entire BRIC, Brazil, Russia, and India, and China combined. And, again, very competitive products with the United States. So you're seeing them move forward in ways while we're kind of stuck in neutral or in park.
Thanks. Mike, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Afghanistan as being something that will kind of overshadow and take, not only overshadow some of the stories, but take a lot of the president's time while he's on this trip. And given that there are so many issues in Asia that sound like they really need some urgent attention, the Japan relationship, the trade relationships, obviously the relationship with China. From your experience planning these trips and going on these trips, how much of a risk is it for the president to have this huge, oxygen-sucking issue kind of trailing him and going along with him?
Well, you know, we in the Bush administration, we faced this on Iraq. And it can have a pernicious effect, you know, on the way over. It's a long flight on Air Force One. They have exercise bikes and showers for the president. You can do a lot of working out, a lot of sleeping. It's a much more comfortable flight than the rest of us are used to. But they do a lot of work, and they get the president ready. They think through issues. If a lot of that time is spent, you know, thinking through health care, thinking through, I mean, inevitably there are other issues on the president's plate. But if it's crowding out the Asia agenda, that's something of a loss. And then when you're in region, Afghanistan-related stories tend to get a big pump. So, you know, in Japan, one of the big uncertainties is, will the Hatoyama government be able to come up with something for a Japanese contribution on Afghanistan? This government has not fully coordinated a lot of its positions, so it's hard to say exactly what their position is. But in general, it appears they're committed to pulling out their ships in the Indian Ocean, which have been refueling the Pakistan Navy and others to help on the fight against terrorism. And they're trying to kind of come up with something that will show they're serious about international contributions. But they're in a coalition with socialists and others who don't want to send the military. And so they're talking about vocational training of former Taliban and things like that. So that's going to, because the Afghanistan question is hanging over, that's going to end up being, I think, a bigger story. The Koreans have actually announced that they're going to send some troops to Afghanistan, which is really quite impressive, because you may recall Noh Moo-hyun promised that he would not send any troops to Afghanistan in order to get some Korean missionaries who had been kidnapped by the Taliban released. So Lee Myung-buck's showing some real courage. But I think that this will sort of highlight the Afghanistan stories. These are not the crucial issues for U.S. relations in Asia, but they're going to be big stories because of what's on the plate for the U.S. president internationally.
Yeah, Mike, the first visit to Japan, the sticking point, which is of Fudema relocation, and obviously the Japanese government side is not going to resolve it before his visit. But I wonder how President Obama is going to work on that issue in the first meeting. And what's the effect of that issue to the overall U.S.-Japan alliance? And also, Bonnie, how the China is going to see this issue on the side of China?
Well, yeah, be careful of the coffees. the Futenma issue is not something that either, I think, President Obama or Prime Minister Hatoyama will want to be the lead story. There are a lot of issues they'll want to emphasize instead, like cooperation on energy and climate. There are also going to be some U.S.-Japan agreements on cooperation on smart grid and other ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And they're both going to want to demonstrate that the alliance is strong. It's in both Hatoyama and President Obama's interests for their domestic publics who support the alliance and in dealing with China to show that we're not going wobbly. But bases are at the very essence of the strategic bargain between the U.S. and Japan. If Japan's not willing to host U.S. bases, the whole arrangement that Asia has grown used to over the last 60 years starts to come apart. And I don't think the new government in Japan wants to kick all the U.S. bases out, but they've basically taken on or challenged the agreement we have to rearrange bases in Okinawa, which is a big, big deal, costly and complicated. And there is no real alternative, and that's becoming obvious. So the foreign minister, Okada, said, we're going to put everything in Kadena, the Air Force base. But the local mayor in Kadena said, over my dead body. So that one's not going to happen. They've explored sending the more of the Marines out of Okinawa, but the U.S. military said, no, we can't do that. We already have a deal. This is the most we can do. It would seriously hurt our operations if you tried to move helicopters hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the Marines in Okinawa. And I think the Japanese government is recognizing that there aren't very many options, but they don't want to say that. So the prime minister said, I'm going to put the decision off. If some of these issues that the Japanese government has put forward, like investigating secret nuclear deals or East Asia community, are fuzzy enough that you can kind of put them off and sort of keep studying them and find a way past them. But this one will only get worse with time because, as you know, there are elections in Okinawa. If they don't move soon, the anti-base movement will gain more and more steam and the entire deal will come undone. So it's not making a decision is the same as saying no. And that's why Gates had no choice but to be quite tough. I think Obama, as president, will have a bigger agenda and want to emphasize other things. But on that issue, I'm pretty confident that privately he'll have the same line as Gates. And publicly, he may not put it in a speech, but if he's asked, I think he'll end up saying similar things to what Gates said. There's a press line in Japan that DOD and state and NSC are all divided on this. I don't think that's true. I think this one's pretty obvious to the administration that they have to get a resolution.
There was a China component to that question. Were you asking how the Chinese look at the U.S.-Japan relationship? Well, first I would say that China, I think, has some concerns and uncertainties about the new government in Japan. On the one hand, very important that Prime Minister Hatoyama said they would not visit the Asakuni Shrine. This is a very important sort of prerequisite to have a good Sino-Japanese relationship. But the Chinese see a lot of potential unpredictability. They were very used to the LDP and the predictability and the relationships. And so I think this is sort of a new equation for them. Having Japan pay more attention to the region, I think the Chinese would see as a good thing, sort of balancing the alliance. The Chinese have been critical in the past that there's been a real overemphasis by Japan on the alliance. But if that whole relationship really were to start coming apart and affecting our bases and U.S. presence, I think there are potential dangers that the Chinese would see there. I don't think the Chinese are looking for a precipitous U.S. withdrawal from the region.
Sean Sullivan with NHK. Thanks very much for taking the time. With regard to the human rights issue in China, what sort of public posture can we expect to see from Obama in these various town halls or speeches or public statements that he might make while he's there?
Well, Mike might have some thoughts on this too, but I think this is not an issue that the president will shy away from. It is important for him to say something on the importance of human rights on our agenda with China. I don't think that's going to translate into him meeting with dissidents, but it's not there, potentially down the road here. As prior presidents have done that, and President Bush did as in when he was president. But I think on this trip, it will come in questions and from the press. It may be part of the public speech that he gives at one of the universities. I doubt we will see this in the joint statement. But I think that the president will state that this is that we stand for greater freedom of religion and interaction, people having more access to the internet. I mean, in Xinjiang, internet access has been shut down since the July 5th protests there. People continue to have a lack of access. There's obviously a lot of sites that continue to be blocked. So I think there'll be a couple of angles that he will focus on. Mike mentioned the Dalai Lama and Tibet policy, and I think that will be a very important component. I think that the decision by President Obama to not meet with the Dalai Lama when he came to Washington was part of an overall approach that the administration had to convince China to reengage with the Dalai Lama's representatives, to be more forthcoming and more sincere in that dialogue. And I think that this has not really borne fruit. Instead, what we have seen is the Chinese have come out with a new statement putting out three preconditions for reengaging with the Dalai Lama's representatives. One of those is a demand that the Dalai Lama not be able to visit foreign countries. And, of course, as a spiritual leader with supporters who are Buddhist all over the world, the Dalai Lama is not going to stay at home and not visit foreign countries. So I think China's position has hardened, and this was outside the expectations of the administration. So I think President Obama is going to be looking for some softening of that position because he is under a lot of criticism, I think, here for having made that decision to not meet with the Dalai Lama, who visited Washington, D.C., and it was the first time that a president did not receive him, the Dalai Lama, his holiness, in 19 years on a D.C. visit.
Let me just add a few points. I saw the Dalai Lama when he was here, and he was willing to obviously give the president a chance to try this new strategy. I think, frankly, he had no choice.
Yeah.
The assumption was that this quiet approach would yield results, and as Bonnie said, it's already obvious that the Chinese have pocketed this concession and are raising the ante. And just to give a few more examples, a number of small European countries like Denmark, whose leaders saw the Dalai Lama, are now being pressed by the Chinese to do various public statements promising never to see the Dalai Lama again before trade agreements will happen. Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, who saw the Dalai Lama before, after the president chose not to, declined to see the Dalai Lama. So this has had a really negative ripple effect internationally for the Tibetans. And as Bonnie pointed out, rather than softening their approach on Tibet, China has actually pocketed this and raised the ante and made more demands. And even the idea that the president's quiet approach would lead the Chinese to re-engage with the Dalai Lama's representative, Lodi Gari, is a bit of a false target, because that was going to happen anyway. The real problem wasn't that they were engaging. They were periodically. The problem was there was no progress in the talks. So I really hope that in this trip the president not only presses privately but makes it clear publicly his support for the Dalai Lama. It's not just about an important international spiritual leader. It's a measure of how China will treat the weak as it grows more powerful. And he probably can't do it on this trip, but I hope very soon thereafter, or maybe even beforehand, there's a clear announcement from the White House when they're going to see the Dalai Lama, because this is really setting the Tibetans back in their efforts to get some reasonable cultural and economic autonomy within China's constitution.
Sorry. There's been some chatter abroad, not over here, that the president, while he's in Japan, could visit Hiroshima. Can you talk a little bit about how that would be perceived abroad and in the Asian countries?
I don't think it's going to happen. First of all, he doesn't have enough time. He's not in Japan long enough. Some people have said maybe he ought to go to Nagasaki. It's a little bit different, because there's some historical debate about whether Nagasaki was really necessary. But it's such a complicated issue. I've been to Hiroshima. A few months after I left the White House, I was asked to be the keynote speaker at that time in the Nagasaki annual commemoration. And it's very moving. It's very meaningful. Our new ambassador, John Roos, went and found it very powerful. I think the president could give a good speech. It would be important symbolism, but it's so complicated politically. You don't want a gesture like this to actually cause a backlash, and I'm not sure President Obama's in a place right now with American veterans or conservatives or other domestic points of view on this issue that it would help. There are two. You hear two arguments about this. One is that if the president of the United States made a trip to Hiroshima and said some conciliatory things, I don't know whether an apology would be politically possible back here. But one argument is that would also encourage Japan to go out and make more conciliatory statements towards Asian neighbors. The other argument is that there's no moral equivalency in trying to project moral equivalency on these different aspects. One, a move that people saw as ending the war, another a move that started the war, would just create a debate that would be unhelpful. It will happen someday. An American president will do this. It may even be President Obama, but not on this trip.
Could you talk a little bit about the sightseeing opportunities for the president on this trip? In China, for example, what would make sense for him to want to visit? What places should he visit? And are there any places he would visit that might be offend the Chinese?
Well, my understanding is that he's going to the Great Wall and the Forbidden City. I don't think either of those would be seen as controversial, either here or in China. He will be obviously showing some respect to China's great heritage and history by going to the Forbidden City and the Great Wall. I don't think that there's anything else because he will really just be in Beijing and Shanghai. I think the touring will be done in primarily in Beijing. And I don't think that the president would go see anything that the Chinese would find objectionable. That's my sense.
I'm wondering if you can compare sort of the overall context of the trip to the Cairo trip, especially in regard to China. If Cairo is about sort of changing hearts and minds overseas and demystifying Islam for Americans, what's the point of this trip? A lot of Americans are kind of scared of the Chinese, and is he trying to make a statement to Asians, and what's the statement?
Well, I think this is a challenge for the president because, as Steve was talking about, there is that sort of notion of G2 out there. And everybody in the region and beyond the region is worried about a U.S.-Chinese condominium. And so the president is calling on the Chinese to step up, to do more to address global issues, but at the same time has to say that China is important to addressing these economic issues, climate change, but we need the rest of the world as well. And it's not just these problems are not issues that the U.S. and China can manage by themselves. I mean, there are also other problems, I think, in terms of messaging to the American people. There are a lot of concerns here, I think, about that persist in terms of the Chinese taking away our jobs and owning all of our treasury bonds. And are they going – people worry, are they going to sell them overnight, which would be, of course, shooting themselves in the foot, and they're not likely to do that. But you know, I think the Chinese, the president does need to talk more about the trade imbalance and China's currency and the needs for China to continue to move toward a floating currency, which they have sort of made in principle a commitment to, but aren't moving to, and moving their economy more towards a consumption-driven economy rather than relying so much on exports. And so those are, I think, challenges also for the president to send those messages here so that people in the U.S. feel a little bit less concerned about the threats that they see economically from China. But, you know, I see this as a really difficult balancing act. And when the president is looking for Chinese cooperation on all of these really important issues and security issues and economic issues, there is, I think, a risk that other people will process this as the U.S. and China are out there to solve all these issues by themselves.
The Cairo speech or the president's U.N. speech will not work in Asia, I think. And if, in particular, the themes about, we're beyond the age of alliances and balance of power and so on and so forth, because the reality is Asia is not beyond the era of alliances and balance of power. And so it's a tough balancing act. On the one hand, he does want to emphasize that we're in an era where global challenges like climate change and terrorism and proliferation require cooperation and that China's got to step up when we want to work with China. On the other hand, if he stops with that, it's going to send a really unnerving message to Korea, Japan, India, Singapore, and other friends and allies in the region. So he's got to find a way to also say values matter, which is one of the things that bonds us to those countries, that alliances matter to us a lot, that we have a role in maintaining peace and stability. There's enough of the Cold War left in Asia that it would be counterproductive to pretend it's not there. And so far, the president's speeches haven't dealt with that latter part. Mm-hmm. They've mostly been – and in Europe, that plays great. The sort of aspirational post-nation-state cooperation on global issues. In Asia, the Asian nation-state is alive and well. Sovereignty, rivalry, balance of power are as much a feature of that landscape as cooperation on global issues. So he's going to have to do a different speech from Cairo and Berlin and New York to play well in the region, particularly with the allies.
I was just going to say, I think his greatest challenge on this trip, given that he's going to be away almost two weeks, is it may come politically at home. When you look at polls of the United States people and what are their top priorities right now, things like Afghanistan, the war on terror, they're all at 1% to 2%, and it's 58% economy or jobs, things like the deficit. And he's been so spending this much time out of the country in Asia, he's got to really be able to make the case why these alliances matter, why this cooperation matters, and why it's going to hit the bottom line for the American people back home. And when the major headlines so far in some of these relations, like with China, have been about Chinese tires unfairly coming into the United States, how do you create this perception that engagement and forward movement on trade and openness to the world is a positive for the American people? So I think that may be the greatest challenge coming out of this in the weeks ahead.
Can I really quickly say, and I worked on the McCain campaign, I worked for President Bush. President Obama deserves enormous credit for the reason Steve just said. Given everything that's happening that's so critical to his presidency at home, he's taking almost 2 weeks in the region that in the long run is really going to be the most critical strategic relationship for the United States. So I'm glad you mentioned that because he deserves a lot of credit for making the political choice to take the time to do that. Bill Clinton skipped two of these APEC summits because of domestic political challenges comparable to healthcare, and President Obama, so far at least, knock on wood, is doing the trip. So kudos for that.
Thank you. John Zan with CTI TV of Taiwan. A few weeks ago, Deputy Secretary of State Steinberg, in a policy speech, urged China to give strategic reassurances to the U.S. On a number of important security and international issues. Will that replace the so-called stakeholder theme in the summit in Beijing? And also, over the past few months, Chinese officials have been talking about Taiwan as being the core interest of China's and urging the U.S. to respect China's core interest. Will that be part of the joint statement that the two sides will sign at the end of the visit? And also, are they talking about arms sales to Taiwan that the Chinese have been pushing the U.S. to stop? Thank you.
On the question of Deputy Secretary Steinberg's speech, I think it remains to be seen whether other parts of the government are going to embrace his concept of strategic reassurance. My sense is that that speech was not very well coordinated, unlike the responsible stakeholder speech that was given by Bob Zoellick in September 2005. And my own expectation is that the president is not going to use that language. If he does not, I think that the Chinese will not really take it very seriously. My understanding is that strategic reassurance will not be used in the joint statement. As I said earlier, they will be highlighting the relationship as an interdependent one. I believe that there will be a reference to China's core interests in the joint statement. My understanding is the way that this is being worked is a sort of Shanghai communique language where one side acknowledges what the other side's position is. I don't think that the United States accepts that China has core interests and we have core interests, so we should necessarily stay out of each other's way. And Taiwan is certainly one of those issues where we have our obligations, our commitments, and our interests and our relations with Taiwan. But I fully expect that this formulation of Xinjiang, Tibet, and Taiwan as being China's core interests will be expressed by Hu Jintao and may, in fact, be mentioned in the joint statement. And I think that it is certainly would be not surprising to me if Hu Jintao raises the issue of arms sales to Taiwan, probably not specifically in terms of what weapons we should or not sell. I think it would be a general warning to President Obama to steer clear of that and not to set back the great progress that has been made in the U.S.-China relationship and most recently the resumption of the military relationship. We recently had a very successful visit here by the vice chairman of China's Central Military Commission, Xu Caiho, with agreement on seven of issues, areas, and how to expand cooperation. And so I think that there may be some signaling there about we need to continue to sustain the momentum and move forward. But I don't think that there will be much focus by either president on the issue of Taiwan. We might have some different views on this. I think this was an instance of the State Department and Deputy Secretary Steinberg organizing his speech and then trying to, instead of getting buy-in before, looking to shape support for it afterwards. There has been some criticism from the right, and I think that is complicating the willingness of other people to get on board with this concept. I think that also people look at strategic reassurance and some say, well, is it just China that's going to give us strategic reassurance, or are we also saying that we should reassure China? And if we're doing that, in what ways are we going to do that? And so people on the right say we really ought to put the whole problem in China's lap, and they should be the ones reassuring us. This is, at least as Jim Steinberg presented it, a two-way street. And although his speech did talk mostly about what the Chinese ought to do to reassure us, nevertheless, in principle, it provides the Chinese with an opening to come to us and say, well, we want strategic reassurance on the following set of things. I don't sense that there are great divisions in the administration about how to move forward with China. They might emerge later, but I do think on this language that there are definitely some differences.
When Bob Zelek did the July 2005 speech about where he called for China to be a responsible stakeholder, he ran that I was in the White House. He ran it by the White House. He ran it by DOD. Everybody was comfortable with it. I think Bonnie's right. This was more of a exploration of themes that you probably won't hear much about after this, because there are concerns about whether this reassurance concept means that we have to stop doing what we do to defend our allies or stand by the Taiwan Relations Act, which was not supposed to be the intent, but that's now being questioned. So I think you probably won't hear as much about it, would be my guess.
Thank you. Jim from the Straits Times. A question on Myanmar for Ernest and Mike. Obama will likely meet with Tencent at the U.S. ASEAN summit. Is that meeting going to cause problems for him domestically? Where is this engagement with Burma going? Is it going to go in the way of North Korea 2.0? Or is it likely to be, how the U.S. engaged with China back in the 70s and bringing it out?
It's interesting you mentioned the China analogy, because Senator Webb and others have tried to use that to say we need to engage Burma in order to, to balance China or to deal with the North Korean nuclear problem. And I think that's a bit of a stretch. The reality was in 1972 there was a compelling strategic reason for both the U.S. and China to get closer to deal with the Soviet Union. Frankly, Burma's not that important. And as to the question of whether President Obama will get some heat domestically, absolutely, because Tencent has a history, and the press, especially on the right, is going to start looking into who this guy is, and he's not a very, well, it's very hard to find anyone to talk to in Burma who's a very appealing character, but he has a particular history of repression that will get the press on board. I think that it's a good thing the administration's trying this engagement strategy. I thought Kurt Campbell framed it perfectly when he came out of the meeting. He was not trying to present a great breakthrough. He wasn't overly optimistic. He said it's an exploration, and I think they're handling it right. He's been very clear that we're not going to lift sanctions. One of the challenges they're going to have is that the engagement process is creating the appearance that we are going to lift sanctions. And it also is a delicate problem, because even as we've done this policy review and engaged the junta, their behavior hasn't gotten better. Yes, Aung San Suu Kyi got out to see Kurt Campbell, but meanwhile, 50 journalists and students were arrested, major military offensives against three or four of the ethnic minorities. So the situation on the ground is continuing to get worse, and sooner or later, I think they're going to have to get some results in order to continue this. And Kurt Campbell's very sober tone suggests they're not confident they're going to get those, but they're willing to explore it, which is probably about the right tone for now.
Yeah, and I would just add, I agree with that. And I think the other thing is that the Burmese, the onus should be put back on them to take the next steps, to show that they're willing to go part of the way. And I think if there's good coordination between the Americans and some of the friends in ASEAN, remember ASEAN comprises, two treaty allies, Thailand and the Philippines. Singapore's relationship with the United States has sort of been over and above treaty ally, even though they're not one. I think we may be able to, if in my wildest dreams about the possible success of the U.S.-ASEAN summit, maybe there could be some coordination and some useful constructive pressure on the Burmese to come out with announcements on how they're going to structure these elections in 2010. In a way that shows that they're willing to, that they got the message and they're willing to allow some space. Am I optimistic about that? Not really. But I do agree with Mike that, Kurt handled it very well. And it's about as, I think, it, as we step down the engagement process, we should be hopeful and watch closely. That's about all we can do.
Tricia Zengerle from Reuters. There have been a few references to President Obama having domestic chits to expend. And can you talk at all in a broader context of presidential politics? Presidents always have a lot of issues on their plate. obviously. Is this a particularly bad time, or is it? Could you put it in that context, how it compares to what other presidents have faced at home when they've tried to pursue a diplomatic agenda? Thanks.
There's a lot of credit for taking out the time to go to Asia. And a lot of the presidency is about decisions, about how much as you said, there's always a world of different things that are out there that you can devote time to. I think what's really different at this point in time is we're facing, you know, the wake of the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression. So you've really had a riveting, both in the United States and globally, on domestic issues, jobs, economic problems. And the great risk is that nations could turn inward. You know, despite all the positive steps the Obama administration has made in terms of engagement, but worry about domestic economic problems and not build the security or economic foundations for global growth. So I give them a lot of credit on that front. I think what they've got to be able to do, though, is translate this action and also into messaging so that it's translated into the American people so that they understand the importance of engagement, the importance of open markets, the importance of trade, and they just don't focus on things like the trade disputes or the other tires and see it as a win-lose situation globally.
But what about in terms of his actually being hindered in being able to come home with anything, you know, the deliverables we've been talking about?
I'll take some ownership of this. I think I said shit. You know, and where I got that from was actually talking with policymakers inside the administration who say, look, we have a certain amount of bandwidth, you know, White House, political juice, chits, whatever you call it, and our top priority is healthcare. And you are asking, you know, or not you, but the Asian friends are asking us to get out there and say something serious about Doha and WTO, and could the Americans give the signal on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which is sort of a precursor to an ASEAN, a free trade area for Asia-Pacific, or the FTAAP or FTAP. And I think that's what our hosts in Singapore would love to see us do. And I think the answer has quietly been, we are working on the messaging that Steve just talked about, but we're not ready. We might not be ready to unfurl that, you know, type of commitment in November in Singapore. And so this is what I meant when I was talking about chits. They just can't take it on board and deliver that politically.
Anne Davies from the Sydney Morning Herald. First of all, do you think there will be any discussion or statements about some of the Chinese comments about the US dollar as a reserve currency and sort of the broader issue of the massive trade imbalance between the two nations? And the other thing is, do you think there'll be any opportunities to discuss an East Asian security architecture as proposed by both Australia and Japan, or whether that's going to be one of those things that's just in the too hard basket for this trip?
Can I take a first crack? We probably should have pointed out that the China trip is being preceded by, of course, the strategic and economic dialogue with Secretary of State Clinton and Secretary of Treasury Geithner, and also the Joint Committee on Commerce and Trade that convened recently. So there's some cabinet-level work that's really gone into the U.S.-China economic relationship. And out of that, you'll see, I think, some themes about rebalancing the U.S.-China relationship to have greater internal demand from China. And I think the administration will portray that as an important mission because it will mean more exports and more jobs. They're not going to get any really concrete deliverables on exchange rates or anything else. In fact, the Chinese are loath to make concessions on things like exchange rates for a summit. They're very different from Japan, Korea, or other relationships where the summits are the pressure that leads to agreements. In China's case, the last thing they want to show their domestic audience is that they've caved to U.S. pressure on something as sensitive as the convertibility of the renminbi or the value of the renminbi. On architecture, I think the administration's fully aware of these debates in the region. They've been very sensitive about this proposal from Prime Minister Hatoyama for East Asia Community, which surprised me because, in fact, Prime Minister Koizumi already agreed to do this in 2005 at a summit in ASEAN. It's not particularly new, and it's not particularly concrete. There are a lot of, you know, different views about values and economic development in Asia. It's not the EU. It's not NAFTA. It's a very long-term thing. But they are quite sensitive to it in the administration, it's clear. I would hope that in Japan, which is the first stop, they can set a positive tone by agreeing that the U.S. and Japan share a common vision for an open and inclusive regional integration. That will require Prime Minister Hatoyama to move away from some of his previous rhetoric about using the East Asia community to balance the U.S. or balance the Anglo-American economic model, this kind of populist rhetoric. And it will require President Obama to then start answering questions about what the U.S. will do about it in terms of trade policy. But that would be the best outcome if they showed that this is a shared vision. And I think Kevin Rudd's original proposal for an Asia-Pacific community, which frankly had a lot of people in Washington scratching their heads at first, now is, I think, viewed as a pretty positive and helpful contribution to the debate, because that clearly is a trans-Pacific a concept, whatever it turns out to be, that would counter the more narrow definitions of the East Asia community.
I think your question was whether the Chinese would say something about the role of the U.S. dollar as right. And I think an exchange rate, certainly, I would agree with Mike. I mean, we've had the head of the Chinese Central Bank come out and say something about moving towards the using of the SDRs, the international currency, reserve currency, rather than the dollar. I think the Chinese like to talk about this in perhaps select settings and are more apt to raise this with their colleagues in the BRICS, you know, Brazil, Russia, and India, then they are likely to raise this in a conversation with the United States. But I think that the Chinese see this as a very long-term conversation in any case. I don't think that they're expecting nor necessarily want the U.S. to stop being the reserve currency anytime in the very near future. But they want to start this narrative, and I think that they prefer to do it with other countries and not really with the U.S.
On what may be one of the most critical issues that we're going to have in terms of trade tensions going forward, because I really think currency could be the terrain on which 21st century trade conflicts or economic conflicts are really fought. You've seen this, you know, prior to the economic crisis, the big push was that China was undervaluing the yuan renminbi and flooding the U.S. market with goods. Now you're seeing this incredible tension in China, Russia, elsewhere, that the United States is going to do what great powers going back to Rome have done when they've got these uncontrollable deficits and no fiscal discipline, that they start printing money or flooding liquidity to devalue things. And there's no mechanism to balance this, as in the WTO. There's no real agreed-upon framework or how you would control something if it got out of control in this area. So you're seeing the G20 and other flag these issues, but you're continuing to see this tension with no real resolution. I'd also point out that Bonnie's group also came out with a report on this, on the reserve currency. So I don't think you're going to see, you know, the dollar's not going to go away as a reserve currency, you know, anywhere, at least in the next probably 10 years. But you're seeing countries like China buy up commodities, buy up land, diversify. You saw India buy a huge chunk of gold. And this is all kind of a, maybe not a vote of no confidence, but a vote of real fear that the United States has got deficits approaching World War II levels, and we've got no real plan of how we're going to back ourselves out of it. So I think this is going to be a real question that's going to permeate or in the background of a lot of these discussions, even if it's not on the front of the agenda.
I will speak to that from the perspective of China's president. I think the Chinese have some concerns about whether this president is going to say one thing and do another. President Obama told Hu Jintao very early on that he would not pursue protectionist policies and then slap tariffs on China's trade imports. The Chinese had a relationship with President Bush that they came to attach a great deal of value and importance to. It was a relationship of a very high level of credibility. They did not always like what President Bush told them. But when President Bush said he was going to do something, he followed through. When he said he was going to give the Congressional Medal of Honor to the Dalai Lama, he did that. And in the next sentence, he also said, and I'm going to attend the opening ceremony at the Olympics in Beijing. And despite a great deal of pressure, both at home and abroad, he never wavered from that commitment. And President Bush also made some important commitments on managing the relationship with Taiwan, with then-President Chen Shui-bian pursuing what was perceived by many to be pro-independence policies. So there's a very high level of credibility in that relationship, which is very important because Hu Jintao knew that what he heard he could take back to the other members of the Standing Committee of the Politburo, and he could take that to the bank. He could count on it. And I think that the Chinese have some concerns going forward about whether they're going to have that level of credibility with President Obama.
Prime Minister Hatoyama won his election landslide in August, on August 30th of this year, in part because the change theme that President Obama demonstrated in the U.S. Really resonated with the Japanese public that was fed up with the LDP. So when Hatoyama says he won because of Obama's example, he really means it. And in fact, in Japan, the president has better numbers than Hatoyama. So a good relationship with him is important. I have heard from Asian diplomats and also from friends in the White House that one of the biggest contrasts between President Bush's approach to these summits and President Obama's is that President Bush treated it sort of like a National Governors Association meeting. He joked. He asked about domestic politics. They talked about politics a lot. It was in some ways more personal. President Bush. Would make a lot of audibles in the summits. He wouldn't raise some issues if he didn't think it was right. He'd raise other issues that came up. It was a bit less scripted, which if you're on the NSC staff is always fun. but frankly, he usually called it right, and he usually decided this is not the right time to raise this issue. What I hear about President Obama is he's very lawyerly and very lawyer-like, and he very scrupulously reads his talking points and articulates things in the complete sentences that they're written in, whereas President Bush would mangle or shorten or add colorful anecdotes. And frankly, people like that. I mean, I think most of his Asian counterparts really liked his style. And as Bonnie said, his style was when I make a commitment, I'm going to keep it. You know, my word is my bond, and you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You know, a governor's way of looking at things. And frankly, that's how a lot of Asian leaders work. So it was a pretty good chemistry. With President Obama, though, he's popular. He's more popular in most of these countries than the leaders are themselves. So they treat him carefully, and he's a rock star, and they're fascinated, I think. And the relationship is important. But he does go through all the issues, apparently. There's no cutting corners, is what I've heard, that he goes through the talking points prepared by the staff, and he reads his brief very carefully, is the general sense that I get.
So thank you all so much for coming today. We'll have a transcript up later at csis.org, and I will be mailing it out to you all individually as well. Thanks very much, and just know that our colleagues will be available while you're on the trip or during the trip. We also have Victor Cha and Charles Freeman, and who are not with us today, but we'll be making them available as well. Thanks very much.